I'm Duncan MacLeod, editor of techcentral.co.za. This is episode 2 of a brand new podcast called Everything PC. And my co-collaborator in this production is none other than Gerard Pretorius. Gerard, good to see you again. Welcome.
Good to be back.
Great. So as we mentioned in episode 1, and by the way, if you have not checked it out yet, I strongly recommend you go back and either watch or listen to episode 1, because this is the second part of a two-part episode where we are looking at the company Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, which is, of course, a big silicon company based out of, where they're based, Silicon Valley, of course. They're near Intel.
Yes.
Santa Clara, I think, so just around the corner from Intel. And founded about the same time, I think maybe 9 months after Intel, AMD pitched up on the scene. And we chatted a bit about why the company is doing so well in episode 1 of this this podcast, which we've called Risen from the Dead. I think anyone who knows AMD's products will get the pun there. Gerard, yeah, we've covered some of the ground, but there's still quite a bit of ground to cover, which we're going to do in this episode. In fact, this whole first season of Everything PC, we're going to have quite a silicon bias. We're going to be talking about some of the big companies in this space and what they're doing. So once we've completed this episode today and episode 3 next week, we'll be having a look at Intel and delving into why they're not doing as well as they used to, what exactly they've done wrong over the last little while, and unpacking what they need to do to get back on track. And Gerard's going to go into a lot of detail on Intel and talk about some of the challenges they're facing. We're also going to look at other companies in the sector, including NVIDIA, the chip graphics card giant, which has, of course, now embraced all sorts of other areas in the data center and in fields from artificial intelligence to machine learning and other applications. Fascinating company that, of course, tried to buy ARM last year and was ultimately unsuccessful under regulatory pressure. And who else are we looking at? I haven't even got the doc up in front of me, Gerard. We're going to look at Apple, of course. Apple has recently become a significant player with its own Apple Silicon and its M1 chips and the rumored M2 chips coming out soon. I was listening to a podcast with Bloomberg reporter Mark Gurman last night, actually, and he was saying that we could see the M2 chips as early as June this year, and that the Mac Pro, which is the only Apple computer that hasn't been transitioned across to Apple Silicon, could in fact debut with a processor called the M2 Extreme. So looking forward to seeing what the details of that are, especially after they announced the studio, the M1 Studio, or the Mac Studio, rather, a week or two ago, which was an impressive looking piece of kit. But let's not get into a discussion about Apple, because we are, of course, here to talk today about AMD. And I wanted to get this podcast going, Gerard, maybe just by having a little look at the history of AMD. They have been around for an extraordinary amount of time. They were, as I mentioned, they were founded just after Intel back in 1969 by a guy called Jerry Sanders, who, if you go and look him up on Wikipedia, looks remarkably like the Colonel Sanders from KFC. similar sort of look to him, but I don't believe he's any relation to Colonel Sanders. And it was, of course, a spin-off, just like Intel was, from a company called Fairchild Semiconductor, which is one of the pioneering companies in Silicon Valley, one of the original companies that really pioneered the space. And, of course, Gordon Moore and others went off to start Intel, and Jerry Sanders and others left Fairchild Semiconductor to start AMD a few months later, and the company has... I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but have they always been kind of seen as a little bit of a poor second cousin to Intel?
It depends. In the beginning, they were just good at making clones.
Right.
So their first aim was basically make more chips for Intel, because Intel couldn't at those beginning times manufacture enough chips. That's why in the old days, you had Motorola was there. You had Mitsubishi making stuff, you had AMD making clones, you had the Russians do their own clones, and then AMD also had memory controllers, which was a big part of their company, making highly accurate memory controllers and cheap ones as well, that they could push it. That's why you could see in the early days of Apple, all the big brand, Dell, HP, those days, when we started moving away from IBM, even IBM used some of AMD's memory controllers.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could, in those days, you could see Intel chip with an AMD memory controller with Motorola on it, and like all the companies all together on one board.
Right.
Which now doesn't exist at all.
Okay.
It's just like doof doof. Here's two companies, and that's it. Everyone is dead, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting. I had a look at the history of this company, and they started actually in their first product was released in 1970. It was something called a MSI shift register. I don't even know what that is, but that was that was their first. Do you know what an MSI shift register is?
Well, registers is basically like how memory is stored and allocated and get. That's it. That's all the basic functions that does.
Okay.
So
That's
where they started.
That's where they started. Right. And then a year later, they entered the RAM chip market for the first time. And in 1977, they were bought, or they sold a large chunk of themselves to Germany's Siemens. And in 1978, their revenue topped $100 million for the first time. And a year after that, in 1979, they listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and that was the first year that they built a fabrication plant, which is in Austin, Texas. And today they don't own any fabrication plants, do they?
No. That's all been sold to now Global Foundries, but that's all. Who owns them again? I think it's...
I'm not sure. Global Foundries? Are they not owned by themselves?
Yeah, it's Global Foundries, but they were bought by someone else giving that name.
I see.
I think it's an Arabic company or something like that that bought them.
Okay.
Because that's what their majority share owned of Global Foundries is an Arabic country.
Right.
UAE country or something like that, I think, owns them.
Could be.
But yeah, there's...
Right. So,
the whole story about selling that off is something what we talked about in the first episode.
Yeah. It's
basically they had to sell that off due to... in the bad days. So,
and which has actually given them an advantage now.
Yes, so we're now still talking about the building up, and then we can then talk about that through their history as
well. Of course.
Because that's also part of the history.
Yeah. And you mentioned Intel. So they reached an agreement with Intel in the early 1980s to start making x86 chips. And that included, and I'm referencing the Wikipedia article here, that included the 8086, the 80186, which I didn't even know existed, and the 80286, and the 80386. I remember those machines. Gerard, are you old enough?
Yeah.
Did you ever own one of these early Intel x86 machines? No.
That's before me. Oh, that's what? Again, I'm still in my 30s, so.
Oh, right. Young'un. Okay. I'm going to show my age now, because my first PC was powered by an 80086 processor.
Well,
it had a green monitor and ran at 4.77 megahertz.
That was the proper Clone Wars.
Mm.
That was
the early days.
The Clone Wars started there badly.
Yeah.
You had the Amigas and all. You still had IBM there as well. Amiga was there. What's the other? Sinclair was there. Who was the other big? Because that's
Compaq.
Ironically, funny enough, Compaq was there as well. So basically, birthplace of HP and Dell.
Yeah. Yeah,
started from there.
Clones, IBM clones. And of course, AMD went on to make clone chips, effectively. Intel x86 chips obviously licensed the designs from Intel.
Yes.
And went on to build a successful business in those processes. And those were the early days. It was a really exciting time. The chips were advancing at a heck of a rate. I personally went from an 8086 to a 286 to a 386. I think the processor name was the 386 DX40 that I had. And I was amazed at how fast it was when I first got this machine today.
Yes, Shanna, the innovation there was rapid and quick and merciless as well.
It was.
Like, buy a new PC, not like, oh, do an upgrade, take your chip up, and no.
Yeah.
Merciless, new chip, new board, new everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the 486. Then there was the 486. Yeah, I had the 486 DX266. I don't know how I can remember all these names. And then the Pentium came along, and of course, all those names are history now. And the Pentium had a famous design flaw, a maths flaw, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yes. Now, that was a bit of a bumble.
It was. It was indeed.
That was a lot of chips. That's now where you can see where AMD started. They kind of pioneering because AMD got so good at making clones, they made clones better than the originals.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, they're making better chips than Intel come themselves.
Yeah.
And then that basically leads off to now.
And then we were getting,
when they started,
we were getting into the late 90s, and of course Windows, Windows 95 had come out, and those Windows 95 machines were so terribly slow, as I can recall. I mean, you can run Windows 95 in a web browser now, but back then it would take on some good silicon, it would take half a minute to load Windows 95 from boot.
Well, the problem is before that, most of the stuff was stored all on RAM or normal flash. Mm-hmm. And then when we started to do proper Windows eras, like a 95 and so forth, mm-hmm. that's when we started using hard drives. And hard drives will always be slower than flash.
Yeah.
So that's why you had a bit of a regression.
Yeah.
But the problem is you had way more storage and everything was just easy to use and the UI was better. And
absolutely. I mean, I remember my 386 had a 40 megabyte hard drive. I didn't know how to fill it.
You could argue, what's it? Some of those futurologists there say, oh no, you only need like a 1 gig hard drive or something. You'll never need more storage than that. Like, eesh.
Or Bill Gates, who's reported to have said 640K ought to be enough for anyone, talking about the amount of memory in a computer. Although apparently that's apocryphal. Apparently he didn't actually say that.
Yes, no. It's like one of those things. Again, there was a couple of guys that said that. I know even Apple had some people say, oh no, you'll never need more of this. Again, what they never is like, in what they see in 6 months.
Yeah, for sure. So the AMD went through an interesting period in the late 1990s and into the sort of first half of the new millennium, when they introduced a series of chips, and these, I've got to refer to these, they had the names K5, K6, and then particularly I remember the Athlon processor, and they had something called the Sempron as well. And they really actually took a lot of market share around the time from Intel. Is this before your time, Gerard? Do you know what AMD was doing right around that time?
That is now early days when I got into it.
Okay.
Because literally when I started basically with computers, that was when I was in like basically grade 4, 5, 6. Okay. So this is now still when it was socketed CPUs. Basically, that's how old we're getting to where I started basically. Okay. So with the K-series chips, that was now the main first big push for AMD to make their own CPUs from the ground up.
Right.
So now you've got a company that can actually from the ground up compete with Intel. And a lot of the stuff they did steal from Intel in terms of ideas. Again, it's not like carbon copies, but you can see it's highly influenced. But there's also then a lot of the ideas that they now learned from all the clones that they did.
Yeah.
They used all of those advanced techniques to actually make a chip better than Intel could. And that kind of was a big wake-up call for Intel. To say, here's a company, a scruffy little company there, with like half the amount of staff, can make a chip better than you.
And they were cheaper.
Well, that's now, again, Intel was reliant on the IBM strategy. Like, you can make it expensive because where else are you going to buy it? So Intel could be way cheaper because the markup there was like stupid. Like compared to what we now used to markups, they did markups there that would make most people now envious. It's like stupid, like 80, 90% markups now, even on normal desktop compliant units.
Consumer
units.
Yeah. And then Intel kind of rose again, didn't they, after that period that AMD had. AMD had that period of success with that series of x86-based chips.
Yeah, now with basically their first success with Athlon 64. Yeah. So the first single core to hit 1 gigahertz, then basically migrating to first dual core. So there was a lot of competition there as well, but you could see this is where we won't see the merger, the weird flux between Intel and then Intel playing dirty, making sure companies don't buy too much from AMD. So AMD rised a lot because they expected them to rise a lot more with money and so forth, but they got kind of underhanded by dirty tactics from Intel,
right?
Which they have been found guilty of.
Yeah.
So it's not as if this is like always they've been fined and punished. And I think the other one now has been thrown out, and that court case has been in the courts for like 20. No, it's almost like 3 years in the European Union.
So what was Intel doing around this time? Was it Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4? Was this the sort
Pentiums,
of...
Pentiums.
Yeah.
That's the... What's it? What do they call them? The Nehalem series and so forth. Where Intel trying to do a completely new architecture.
Okay.
Like a completely revolutionary and all those things. And it flopped like a... Yeah. That's. I don't think Intel's ever made a flop like that ever since.
Maybe the Itanium. Maybe the Itanium processor. That was a big
flop. I would say it's even worse than that.
Oh, really?
Because Itanium at least had like use cases and you could see where it was going. This was like, it fundamentally did not even work.
Yes.
Like, it worked, but it was so crap. Like, even the older Intel stuff was better than it.
These were the slower days of Intel. This was still IA32 architectures, right? This was before 64.
Now, this is now before we get to the core architecture. Mm. Well, the 64 started, because again, that's AMD. Now where we get into AMD, hence why you've got anything that you program that says 64-bit says AMD 64-bit.
I've always wondered about
that.
If you
go in your current, that's now because it's AMD intellectual property, and AMD gets paid for that intellectual property.
So they pioneered. That's where they pioneered 64-bit x86 chips, did they?
Yes. So what AMD pioneered is they could get their 64-bit working in 32-bit as well.
Uh-huh.
So they could run 32 and 64-bit.
Ah.
So that's why in Windows you'll see ones that says x86 and the other one just says program files. That one that says x86 is the old way of doing it.
Okay.
So that's where old programs go in to get used.
Right. Stupid question there. So a 64-bit processor shouldn't be referred to as an x86 processor.
Well, they're all x86. That's the bane how it's worked. But you get now 32-bit instructions and you get 64-bit instructions.
Okay.
And now you can use it depending on your libraries. Because, again, a 32-bit, you're only limited to about 4 gigs, normally under 4 gigs of RAM that you can access at the time. Okay. Whereas with 64-bit, it's one stupid amount of fucking amount of memory that you can access for that program.
Right.
So AMD found a way how to get a processor to work with both.
Yes.
Because Intel had Itanium, which was either 32-bit or 64-bit.
Yeah.
You couldn't run both on that processor.
Yeah.
The processor had one thing and that's it. Which is kind of a bit of a problem if you have legacy software that you need to install on new machines and the new machine says, no, you have to rewrite your whole software to get it working.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons why Itanium completely flopped as well, is not just that fact that it couldn't run 32-bit instructions at all.
Okay.
So that's the first problem that Itanium had, and the second, there was design problems with that. So that's why now you get x86, which is owned by Intel. Intel owns the instruction set for x86.
Okay.
But now Intel licensed that to AMD, and then AMD licensed back 64-bit version of x86.
That must burn Intel. That must really burn Intel.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, if AMD didn't do that, they wouldn't be around now.
Oh, basically. Right. Okay.
It's like the two companies are now interlocked with one another.
So I've often...
None of them will kill one
joined
another.
Joined at the hip.
Well, it's even worse. It's like having your evil brother and sister next to you, and you're like, okay, we need to work together, otherwise we'll burn both of us.
It's a bit Russia and the US and their nuclear weapons and mutually assured destruction. The first nuke that someone fires, they're both destroyed.
You can kind of say that. I would say it's probably a bit more respectable now, but in the olden days I think it was a bit more bullish with that, because it's like Intel higher ups that back then were not as friendly as they are now compared to
so I've heard of the IA64 architecture, Intel Architecture 64. How does that differ to AMD 64?
Well, basically that's just the implementation of 64. Okay. So AMD needs to license this, but I cannot make an exact copy,
right?
Because then it's intellectual property problems.
Okay.
So it's just you need to license it that you can use some of it, but your implementation still needs to be different.
Okay.
So that's just the only main difference between that, is just the way it...
But they're basically the same.
How
the chip
physically functions, works, and how the operating system interacts with the chip.
But for all intents and purposes, as an end consumer, it's the same thing.
For our viewers and so forth,
yeah,
that's base level. You can get more complex, but honestly, that's more for the engineers and the people that work for Intel AMD to really worry about.
Right. So we've been using 64-bit chips for going on 20 years now. Do we ever go to 128-bit, or is 64-bit all we need to do?
No. This is one of those things where it's like, this is not in the days of 8-bit and 2-bit PCs and it was Sega, and you had the Segas and so forth, and Nintendo's 32-bit and 64-bit, and it's like, that's pretty much, because with 64, the amount of memory you can access is at the same time, it's such a stupid multiplication that Maybe eventually in the future, but then we'll probably be long dead by then. That's how far in the future we'll have to go. Like this, now we're talking about quantum computers and graphite computers that might change that completely, but not, this is not something we'll see in the next 20 years.
Now, back in, I forget the date now, it was, I think it was around 2005 or 2006, somewhere around there, mid-2000s, the mid-noughties, as they put it, AMD bought a graphics chip company called ATI, and we did touch on this briefly in the last, in the first episode, but I thought let's go into it in a little bit more detail. This was the early days of computer chips. NVIDIA was around then. I think they'd been founded in the late 1990s or somewhere around there. They'd taken an early lead, if I'm not mistaken, in the graphics card market. There were other players in the space other than NVIDIA and ATI, but they seem to be, those two seem to be emerging as the two front runners. I remember some of those ATI cards, and in fact, I may have even had one in my PC at one point. AMD came along and they bought ATI. What was the thinking there? I mean, Intel wasn't producing high end graphics chips at all, and still don't. Well, but although they're planning to.
Well, now that's, I think AMD played it smart, because AMD kind of knew that eventually there's going to be a time where we're going to have mergers. You're going to have APUs where you're going to have more than one thing on it. So it was because AMD didn't have enough staff like Intel did, because Intel by that time was also humongous. The amount of people they had, the amount of talent they had, AMD couldn't compete with that type of thing. So the only way you can compete with that is just buy another company and kind of like do a shortcut.
Right.
So that's what the idea was behind getting ATI, is so that it's easier for them to compete with Intel when Intel goes into GPUs as well. Because there was a big thing of Intel actually going into the GPU market.
Yes.
Like a lot of people, I think even NVIDIA kind of feared that Intel would do that, because if Intel went hardcore in the graphics by then, they could completely dominate the OEM market. Like all your laptops, pre-built machines, they would just zing all of them.
Right.
So I think there was a bit of overcaution and just thinking, oh, Intel will do that. And then Intel did go into the graphics, but not to where ATI and AMD was at any concern, because it's like, okay, they're not doing gaming. They literally just cannot run a display, and that's basically the minimum requirements.
So what did they do with that acquisition? I mean, ATI Technologies, I'm just looking at their page on Wikipedia. They were founded 37 years ago in 1985 as Array Technologies. And ATI acquired them, there we go, it was in 2006. And also a fabless company, so other people manufactured their chips for them. With the decline, I'm reading here, with the decline and eventual bankruptcy of 3DFX, I'd forgotten about that company, in 2000. ATI and its chief rival NVIDIA emerged as the two dominant players in the graphics processor industry, eventually forcing other manufacturers into niche roles. So yeah, it really became those two companies. But what happened to ATI after the acquisition? Because you can't buy an ATI Radeon graphics card anymore, can you?
Well,
they
do
Vega. They do Vega graphics now.
Well, it's Vega is just the name of it. They all called Radeon. They're still called Radeon.
Okay.
Yeah, Radeon. So if you go to AMD, you'll see it's a Radeon graphics and so forth. So that's still ATI. Even if you look at the drivers will still reference ATI.
Okay.
Because it is still that, it is still, they've now more, it's, you can see it's more of like, in, even in those days it was more of a merger, but then that merger became like a fusion where they just merged into one thing.
Yeah.
So you now just see them as AMD, like you would see Intel, but Intel had, you also have different divisions. So they will just call those the Radeon divisions, and
okay.
I think you'll see him change it, but Radeon will basically be the name for that.
You can tell how embedded I am in the world of NVIDIA that I don't even know that the Radeon brand is around anymore. Yeah. But of course, the RX 6000 series is
to be a teaser there, because the Wikipedia thing is leaving a lot out. Okay. Because I will talk more about this when we do the NVIDIA podcast.
Yeah,
the problem is NVIDIA was kind of beating everyone with a stick.
Okay.
They were not pretty. They would literally steal your stuff and then sue you, or they'll sue you, and then they'll sue you for something else, and then drive the company to bankruptcy and then buy them.
It's the American way.
Yeah, it's basically one of the companies that pioneered it.
Yeah.
Because they did in the early days, and they were ruthless.
Yeah.
Like, even more ruthless than Intel. That's how bad NVIDIA was that. But we'll take that when we get to the NVIDIA podcast.
Because and the Intel podcast.
They did at the NVIDIA podcast because they were real bastards. Yeah. And that will lead to other things. But that's where, and that's now basically you could say it's kind of a good thing that AMD bought them.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of bad then because it cost AMD a stupid amount of money that they could really have spent somewhere else if you just want to go on with CPUs.
Yeah.
But like this now, it means ATI will always be there to compete against NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because NVIDIA was at the point where they would just kill everyone, make sure there's no competitors.
Yes.
Which would be ultimately bad for us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they're still in this business, the AMD Radeon line of yeah. graphics cards. How competitive are they relative to NVIDIA? I mean, the RX 6000 series. I've never played with one of these cards. How do they stack up to say an RTX 3080?
Well, at the current, if you're looking at the AMD 6000 series and NVIDIA 30 series, it's pretty much.
Is it?
Neck on neck now. Okay. So I've got the 6900 XT on my machine.
Okay.
And again, I have had 3080s. I've not had a 3090 though, but I've had 3080s and so forth. And so far, for my use case, which is predominantly gaming. So far, the 6900 did a bit better than the NVIDIA cards for me.
Okay, that's interesting.
Again, I've also had bad luck with NVIDIA. It's one of those things where normally when I get an NVIDIA card, I would get more faulty cards and have more issues.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the moment, NVIDIA does dominate in terms of mindshare, which is like Apple type of mentality.
Good at marketing.
It depends because it's again, we can get to that when we do the NVIDIA one because a lot of that marketing is also, they do that ruthlessly by paying companies to make sure people in forums talk about NVIDIA and bash AMD.
Interesting. Interesting.
So NVIDIA is the, like, this is the company you follow if you want to see, if you want to really dominate a company by just bashing your company, if you have a lot of money, you can pay anybody to do some nasty stuff to make you sure you win. So
aren't the CEOs of AMD and NVIDIA related to each other?
Oh, probably cousins and so forth.
I think they are.
Again,
yeah.
it's normally I tell people it's like, Jensen is under the brief. The dude is not dumb. He was a good chip designer.
Jensen,
I don't know how much.
Jensen Huang, this is the CEO of NVIDIA. Yes. The guy who always wears the leather bomber jackets.
Jacket, yes. Leather jacket and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the dude is smart. I would say he's probably more business smart than actual tech smart.
Right.
Because the dude knows how to run a company and how to get the marketing guys. And the marketing guys he got to hire because he took a couple of guys from Intel as well.
Yeah.
Hence why they did all those dirty tricks and so forth. But it clearly paid off.
Yeah.
They make a stupid amount of money. And now they've got their own niches that both AMD and NVIDIA didn't really look at all. So now that we're talking about GPUs, AMD is now catching up with AI. That type of, even Intel is now looking at making GPUs specifically for AI research and for that type of workloads.
Yeah, yeah.
So AMD already has a couple that compete and so forth, but AMD still needs to work on their software sides and so forth, making it easy for guys to implement it. And there's a lot of stuff that just needs time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you can fix with money.
Yeah.
Money helps, but money doesn't buy you time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. I wanted to get a picture of Jensen Huang up on the screen, but I'm struggling here. There we go. No, it's not working. I'll get it up as we carry on chatting. Interesting history for AMD, and of course they're very competitive, as you mentioned in the first episode last week, with Intel now, and in some respects they've overtaken Intel in some of their chip designs and what they're doing. I don't want to rehash what we did in the first episode, but just very briefly, why is AMD doing so well in 2022 relative to Intel?
Well, basically it's making a good architecture, so out engineering your company. And then just changing the game.
Yeah.
So going from the traditional way we would think of making chips and all those things, changing that completely and using that to their advantage and pushing their advantage hardcore.
Yeah.
Like Intel did in their days when they had the first, core architectures and so forth, which were brilliant. Like, and when you push your advantage and you push it, go for it. Like, and that's where AMD's now rocketed all the way up and used more and more advantages, and that now leads up where AMD's board got more higher engineers and better engineers and And again, all credit to Lisa Su for her vision in saying, here's the company, what do we need to do in the future? Because whatever you do now, whatever product you're launching this year is a product that you designed and started thinking about almost 5 years ago.
Yes.
So yes. Getting that right, where you can think 5 years in the future from now, that pays off. So that's how AMD won, is just doing the old school elbow grease and hard work, and it paid off handsomely now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still struggling to get these pictures on the screen. There we go. If I hit that button, it should come up. There we go. So that's Jensen Huang on the left in his trademark leather jacket, CEO of NVIDIA, and on the right, it's Lisa, what's her name? Su.
Lisa Su, yeah.
And she is the CEO of AMD. And apparently they are related. I'm just looking at a fact check here. Not technically uncle, but still related. Yeah. Lisa Su's own grandfather is actually Yen Sun Huang's uncle. Although they aren't really niece and uncles, they are very close relatives. There we go.
Yeah, so... but yeah, she comes from IBM. She's an old school chip designer, so okay. She knows her chip stuff. She, funny enough, she was one of the engineers working on the cell processor that was used in the PlayStation.
Oh, yes.
And IBM's big data center processor. She was one of the architects behind it.
Okay, very smart lady.
So as is she is. Oh no, yeah. She's smart. That's one thing I'll give her. She can literally debate with chip designers when they make a chip.
Okay.
She can sit there and say, oh, okay, she knows what you're talking about.
Yeah.
She's not like a normal CEO that's like, oh, I don't know. She can sit with engineers and make a chip.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is an advantage.
It's interesting, actually, what you mentioned about CEOs, and perhaps a bit of a side discussion here, but certainly in this space, and it's probably true across the tech industry in the US in particular, but the founder CEOs of these companies, compared to markets like South Africa, which I guess are reseller markets in tech,
yes.
you very often find they are led by the most incredibly talented engineers who know the absolute intricate detail of everything about the product strategy. You don't find that often in many industries. I mean, often you find the CEO of a company is an accountant, is CA or similar, or someone with an MBA running the company. I mean, Tim Cook is an example at Apple. He's not a technologist. He's not an engineer. He's got great engineers working for him. But in many cases in Silicon Valley, and particularly in this space, it seems that in the Silicon space, it seems that it's an advantage where your CEO actually has an intimate knowledge of what's happening. We saw it at Intel, for example, and we've seen Pat Gelsinger returning to the company. He is a through-and-through engineer. He understands exactly what the product strategy is.
Yeah. So I would say for big companies like that need to work far in the future.
Yeah.
You need to have someone there as a CEO that can say, what are we doing? Where are we going?
Yeah.
And understand what are the problems.
Otherwise, the engineers will BS you.
Well, the problem is that engineers are not social creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Normal engineers are people that sit back, they bit more. You need to get it out of them.
Yeah.
So you need to kind of be able to talk their language
and understand what matters,
and understand the problems they have. So
engineers
need to have the feeling where they can walk up to the CEO and say, "We have this and this and this problem."
Yeah,
and the CEO can say, "Okay, how can we fix this?"
Yeah,
and start with fixing. That's why it's also quite interesting that a lot of engineers that are a bit more social become CEOs so easily. Right. It's because they are very good at looking at big pictures,
yes,
and then snipping out all the important bits and then going into extreme detail with it, because that's what engineers also do, is they solve problems.
Yes,
they look at a problem, here's the one massive problem, and they break the big problem into small problems and then basically try and fix all those small little problems.
Yeah.
And that's what the CEO also needs to do.
Yeah, in this space,
it's literally, it's, well, in my opinion, any business.
It's well, like if you're selling if you're selling baked beans, I mean, if you're Tiger Brands, do you really need a CEO who understands?
Well,
farming?
You need to know. Well, the problem is that you should, if you really want to be really great at your thing, you should be able to know, how does the can work? How does the can manufacture? Can you make the canister even better? Can you make them lighter, being with the same strength?
Yeah.
as a proper CEO, you need to look at everything and break it down. That's why Steve Jobs was very good at that.
Yes.
Even though he wasn't engineer, but you could see that little cog and little mouse running there in his head, thinking of how can he get his engineers to make stuff better?
Yeah.
So if you're not a engineer style like that, like you will see now with Intel and AMD and NVIDIA and so forth, they have that. But if you have a CEO in charge that actually looks at the problems, thinks every day, he thinks, how can I make this better? Mm. How can I interact with this better? How can I make that better? And that's why, in some point, you could see a bit of Apple like falling a bit back, because like, how many things can you call now that Intel has, that Apple has changed in the past 5 years?
Yeah.
That's revolutionary compared to what he did. Because he went and said, sweet, we did. He did all the different machines and how you interface with it. He was big behind making different UIs. So he, again, Jobs was his own little but the dude knew what he was doing, and he was arrogant enough to say, go for it.
Yeah.
Which you give him credit with, but again, to say he was a
There's
no likely about that as well. But
no, he used to chew out employees in the elevator. It's legendary.
The problem is it's very similar to, because Gates also did this.
He did. Yeah.
In those days it was very shouty.
Yeah.
Because there was a little of like, you need to defend your point to the death, basically. Yeah.
Difficult to get away with that today, actually.
Yeah, exactly, because that's now we a bit more nicer in culture, which is fine, because some people don't, you can still get good people to do astonishing things if you don't be a like that.
Yeah.
But in those days, that was the kind of mentality where it was a bit of a shouting match, and then Jobs, the problem with Jobs was basically he went a bit too, sometimes he would take stuff too personal. Gates was very good at taking the shouting match, and you can see that in top levels of Microsoft then. They could take the shouting match, and when it was done, it was done, and nothing was too personal. It wasn't like you attacking me personally. You were attacking your idea. Your idea is crappy. But your idea is not you. Your idea is just what you thought of and doing. So that's what that was about. So that's what now AMD made quite good there. Lisa Su could look at the problem, because I think just before Lisa Su became the CEO, she was actually picked by... What was the guy? Because basically AMD got so bad that the company kind of went into business rescue type of thing.
Bankruptcy protection.
I don't think they would say that, but they went into that. So then they got the guys. I can't remember what was his name now.
Can't help you, I'm afraid. Was
the CEO of AMD then.
We'd have to look it up. Yeah, no, she's been amazing. She's been the CEO for quite some time now.
Yeah, Roy Reed.
Don't even remember him.
He was in place.
Yeah.
And he basically, like, redid the whole company.
Okay.
And he was now a proper, like, CEO that you could say. He's in there to see where the talent is and put the talent where it needs to be. So then that's why they got Jim Keller back to main one of the big architectures behind AMD Zen, and got all those people in place. And then Zen 1 came out, Zen 2 came out, and then you can see this AMD's tradition of iteration.
Yeah.
That was also now very different from where Intel was stagnating for a long time.
Yeah.
AMD, the Zen 1, Zen 2 is an iteration of that improvement with different architecture improvement. And you can see the complexity also ever increasing every time they make the newer chip.
Mm-hmm.
From this, we move and not just use the same thing and then... and escalate the difficulty, and then that also helps you now with making better chips and all those things. And then that now leads, now that AMD is in this position where they're starting to ramp up the difficulty, now you need to say, sweet, what do we need to become more and more competitive with the difficulty scale going up?
Mm-hmm.
And that now leads to our Xilinx acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, nice segue there. So AMD has now, just completed this acquisition a couple of weeks ago. $50 billion, that's with a B, $50 billion, a little bit bigger than the ATI acquisition of 2006. And it's really a merger, isn't it? I mean, it's a stock deal, and it's really a merger of equals. I don't know much about Xilinx until we started talking about this podcast a few weeks ago. Obviously heard the name, but it's not really a household name like AMD and Intel.
No.
Yet $50 billion, this company's big. Who are they? What do they do? And why has AMD bought them?
Well, they're an American company, and their main frame in the market is FPGAs. So they do other things, but for our audience, our main focus would be FPGAs.
Now, what
so,
is an FPGA?
Well, that's now a field programming array. So basically, the advantage with FPGAs is you can make them. Let's use why FPGAs have been useful in the space program. So you send a shuttle up into space or your rocket up into space and so forth. So now what happens is your vehicle only has one processor. So the advantage now what you can do with a field program array is you can then change it as you go. Most chips, once you've made it, it's set in stone. You can't change the fundamental operating system of or operate how the thing actually functions.
Right.
So now with FPJ, so when you go into space and now it's in orbiting mode, it has a certain specific way how it does that. Then it goes into lander mode. Then it literally changes the whole way the processor works and how it does that. Then it does that and goes to lander mode, and now it's in, now if you say rover mode. The rover mode is, it completely wipes the actual function of how the CPU works and changes it completely to be a rover now. Because in space, you don't have enough space to have multiple processors.
So Gerard, I think you're going to have to take a step back. You've lost me completely. Okay. So we're talking about field programmable arrays. Just explain this in language, like so a dummy like me can understand.
I'm trying to explain because it's a difficult concept to get across, because it's literally the field array can be programmed.
Right.
So literally how the actual transistors functionally work and compute can be changed.
Okay.
So what I was trying to explain with that is, like NASA and so forth would have, there's only one processor on the actual rocket that you send up. That's why most of those companies that use that is military companies use FPGAs. You get big portion of it is for aeronautical and space and so forth, because it gives you that functionality where you can change the functionality of the chip as the mission progresses. Because normally you would say for this stage, you have, instead of having multiple different chips for each stage, you can have one chip do everything. And that chip, you can literally just kind of flash it to whatever mode you need it to be.
Right.
So that's the advanced thing that you can do with that. So now for AMD, where FPGAs are very important, is from what I understand now, most companies use FPGAs to test their CPUs and GPUs before they get manufactured.
Right.
So you literally emulating the whole way the chip gets, how the whole chip functions, so that you can have a very good idea of where are the problems and where can we do improvements, and does it actually functionally work without needing to make the chip first. You can literally, and you can even more advanced, is you can actually emulate parts of the chip even. You don't need to make the whole chip. You can emulate certain parts of the chip and say, oh, will this work? How will it work? And then you can actually add stuff as you go. So that's why FPGAs are very expensive to manufacture, because it's difficult to have that functionality where you could reprogram the array the whole time.
Yeah.
And then basically, and then now the main other focuses, as you look through the site and so forth, they do a lot of like networking stuff as well.
Yeah.
So you get dedicated FPGAs for networking. So stuff that is heavy bandwidth bound. So you'll see them in like supercomputers and so forth, for how they can interface between actual SSDs, how you would contact with amount of networking data that comes in and so forth. So stuff that have massive bandwidth, which also then leads on to those type of advancements and innovations would lead kindly to stuff that AMD is trying to do with graphics cards, because that's all bandwidth weight.
Okay.
CPUs as well. The more bandwidth you can give the CPU to interact with more things, the better. So that's where you can push that more advancement in. So I would say AMD bought, the main reason why would AMD buy Xilinx is they are the pioneers in the like in their field compared to most of the other companies. So now they have a company internally that they can use to test their own equipment. So they can literally say, instead of, because AMD did previously go to Xilinx to get their design for their chips to make them and all those things. So it's not as if they don't know who they are. Everyone knows them. Even NVIDIA uses them. Everyone actually uses them.
Interesting.
Most people that actually, even if you make an ASIC, your ASICs get designed predominantly on a FPGA first. And then once you've got your FPGA, once you have your ASIC and so forth, then you can manufacture that. But you use these, you need to have this type of technology first before you can make the other ones much easier.
Interesting. So $50 billion to buy this company, was it worth it, do you think?
Yeah.
Does it change the game for AMD?
Well, in terms of, if you're looking at connectivity, so GPUs. So basically, what we've seen now with Apple, the Apple Max, with its controller where it can merge two chips together.
Yeah.
AMD's already done this with their Instinct cards. Apple's basically doing the same as what AMD's doing already. So AMD's already launched their card last year. Apple's basically taking that. From the next gen chips that are coming from AMD coming now, I tell people the complexity is way higher. Like, whatever you think of Apple now, you think this is advanced, this is like child's play compared to what AMD is trying to do with their next gen stuff. Mm-hmm. We're talking about chips that can talk to one another as if they are one big chip without any penalties.
That's what Apple's doing. That's what they've announced, yeah.
Well, there is a penalty. That's the problem.
They is there a penalty? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
They've admitted there is a penalty with it. Mm. So I thought it was like, it's the way they've done it is the easy way. Again, AMD's done also the same with their graphics card. That's why AMD knows the problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bigger the GPUs you make, and they're going to get just bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Same as Apple, they're going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But you need a company. Now, these are technologies based off from TSMC.
Mm.
But they can only give you the groundwork. You still need to do the work to get those things to connect and how it works and so forth. And that's where AMD is now trying to pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the areas where Xilinx is really good at, is heavy bandwidth, how to optimize. And then, again, you need a company to optimize your stuff, because that's also one area where I think not a lot of people know them, but they are hyper good at efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
They can make a chip. What they've got, some of their FPGAs that are like, I think 50 watts or 60 watts. You look, give or take, it'll probably be like close to 80 watts. And that 80 watt chip for mining, for certain applications with mining with certain currencies, can mine as well as a 3090 at 75 watts versus a chip that's pushing close to 350 watts. So their company is, and I know a lot of people in the industry said, no, these guys know how to make something efficient, like stupidly good at efficiency, because that's the main thing. They make FPGAs for military purposes and for space and so forth. And again, all of those applications need you to be as powerful as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just for science applications. I mean, and it's not just in countries like South Africa where there's a power deficit, but there's a demand worldwide to reduce the footprint of your energy consumption because of the...
Yeah, well, it's twofold.
Mm.
If the less power you use, the more power you can give it to do twice as much, basically.
Yeah.
So if you can get power down by 30%, it means you can increase power and even get more performance.
Yeah.
Which is for hyperscalers and so forth, that's where they also in. So the other advantages as well with Xilinx is Xilinx has a good media backbone.
Right.
So with capture cards and so forth, quite a good bit of them are actually using Xilinx technology in them.
Okay.
Like most of the sports studios and so forth, and racing, like F1 and all those things and so
Interesting.
Forth.
Interesting.
Most of them
in
all
AV.
Run. Mm. They are big in that area, which again is a big advantage for AMD, because basically I wouldn't be surprised in the next two generations that AMD will have a capture card built into their GPU.
Wow.
Because it's easy. It's part of a company. You can just make a small chip, put it in the card, and there you go. Make a one HDMI port that can do both in and out, and then you've got a capture card built into your machine. Why do you need a capture card anymore?
What does this acquisition mean for AMD's competitors, particularly NVIDIA and Intel?
Well, Intel has their own company that they've already purchased, and so Intel has already been using FPGAs for quite a while and so forth. Unfortunately, they haven't hit the market penetration like Xilinx has because, right. I don't know, Intel mismanagement. I don't know because it's like Xilinx basically just took it and just went because there's no real other big competitors in FPGA like Xilinx.
Mm-hmm.
So Intel, at least, I think they're fine because, again, they bought the FPGA company for themselves because they needed the tooling also to design their own chips because they're very secretive, Intel. They don't want to give you their own IP to that. For NVIDIA, on the other hand, basically, NVIDIA has enough money to where they can get that skill set in and so forth, but it is a bit of a heavy disadvantage for them. Again, AMD, they're just getting more people in the AI field. They're getting more people in areas where they were lacking. So NVIDIA still has a lot of presence in the AI, so I think they're pretty good there. In capture cards, they have a good encoder already. AMD might probably have a better encoder coming now with Xilinx acquisition. So I would assume the next gen graphics cards from AMD coming out will probably have a capture card equally, if not better, than what NVIDIA has now.
Interesting.
So it's AMD just using Xilinx to catch up in fields that they were lacking in. But then now using that as a more advantage of now AMD's advantage where they have a better team in terms of making their chips more efficient than yours.
Yeah,
which is a bit of a problem for both Intel and NVIDIA because now it's like NVIDIA is like, okay, they're good at efficiency, but I think the next cars launching end of this year, AMD is going to completely dominate power efficiency, both in CPUs and GPUs. Both Intel and NVIDIA are going to look really stupid.
That's the will that be the 7000 series from AMD? Radeon 7000.
It's not going to be. That's going to be, I think they're going to call both 7. So I think the CPUs are going to be 7th generation and the GPUs. And they're doing that on purpose.
Okay.
They're going to do the 7 because 7 is it's a lucky number.
And we're going to deal with Intel and NVIDIA in future podcasts. Of course, NVIDIA is due to release its 4000 series graphics cards later this year as well, which will go head-to-head with the 7000 series from AMD. And Intel is getting into the graphics card game as well, which we'll deal with in the Intel podcast next week.
Not that, but yes.
You're completely immersed in this world, Gerard. So we've got these three giants in tech, Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA. If you were to, knowing what you know about these companies and where they're positioned competitively, throwing it forward 3 years, which of these three companies do you think is going to be the most successful in that period? Especially given that Intel has a new leadership now.
AMD will most certainly in the server market and high compute platforms. AMD is going to scale massively. So server, they still have in the bag because Intel server is very disappointing, their server market. So AMD still pioneers the server market and they will still dominate that for the next 2 years.
Right.
Probably third, but Intel is trying to get Ponte Vecchio and all their hyperscalers up and running. At the moment, it's all, here's the piece of paper and here's a little photo. Nothing in reality yet. But we'll have to see that. NVIDIA, on the other hand, they're still good in the next couple of years, but my problem with NVIDIA is the next 10.
Okay. Why is that?
Because Intel is making GPUs.
Yes.
Now, the current ones that are coming out this year are going to be mid-range to low-end mainly. But my problem is Intel wants NVIDIA out of the OEM market.
Okay.
You can see this. I can tell people now, it's like, you can look at me now, Intel wants to get NVIDIA out of the OEM market.
They hate them that much, do they?
It's not hate, we've seen how much money you make. We want that.
We want your cash, boys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is one thing that NVIDIA kind of seen, but in my opinion, they didn't really up the ante. Because it's like kind of like, you can see this NVIDIA where they're just kind of like, okay, we'll just go up in the higher end. So as soon as you go up in the mid-range and low end, that's what we'll see. Look at NVIDIA. They may be focusing now on the high. Basically, any card below the 3070, in my opinion, NVIDIA doesn't care about. Anything below the 3070, it's like, nah, we don't really care about you.
They don't make enough money out of it.
It's not enough money, but they don't drive sales. 30 series will still mark up most of their sales.
Right.
But the 3090s and the marketing people push those high-end cards because you use the high-end cards to sell to cheap cards. Unfortunately, most people are a bit dumb that are not like us in the field.
Right.
So they buy the cheaper cards because, ooh, they've got the fastest card.
Right.
So, and again, it puts NVIDIA in a position where that's why they pushed AI and all those fields. They went into markets where there is no competition, which is kind of like, smart in one hand, I can say, but dumb in the other hand, because it's like, okay, now what if there's a competitor that comes in and like smash you in the head? Then what? What, you're going to run away? What is NVIDIA's plan? What are they trying to do in the next 10 years? And that's my key problem. Because AMD, they've got a good relationship with OEMs and so forth. So it would be easy for AMD and NVIDIA and Intel to take those markets. Mm-hmm. Especially that the fact that a lot of companies don't like dealing with NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll get to that on the NVIDIA one, because that's their own little story of where they dug their own grave there. But that's my main problem with NVIDIA. Is NVIDIA is probably the one that, because they are so high, they are the ones who lose the most.
Yes, yes.
And that's where I'm, because I want NVIDIA still to be there. That's my problem. Mm. NVIDIA has some stupidly good talent, and they have geniuses working there.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, where are you going? Is that your market purely just in hyperscalers and AI, and you'll just, if the GPU market gets too difficult, whatever, you're just going to drop it and say, eh. Because that's the kind of vibe I get from NVIDIA. It's just like, if it's too much effort and nobody wants it, and we'll just drop it and go away. We'll just give up and go to somewhere else.
Sounds a bit like, it's a bit like Google's product strategy. dropping products when they don't work. Yeah,
exactly. That's not my problem. And it's like, NVIDIA doesn't have the amount of intellectual property like Google and all these other companies. So, I can't say. That's my problem with NVIDIA.
Yeah, yeah. So isn't this a fascinating chart? I just pulled this up on Yahoo Finance. This shows Intel, AMD, and NVIDIA's share prices over the last 5 years, based to 100 at the start. Now, the yellow and light blue lines are AMD is in yellow here, and this light blue line over here is NVIDIA. So that's AMD, that's NVIDIA. This purple line right at the bottom that's gone nowhere for 5 years is Intel. Just shows you the extent of the trouble that Intel is in, doesn't it? So Intel is up 33% over this period, whereas NVIDIA is up 900% and AMD is up 700%. So if you'd put your money into Intel, you'd really be kicking yourself.
Well, it depends, because Intel is, it's guaranteed money. They are safe bet. They're not going to go anywhere. They are the
also not going to make much money if you're an investor.
Well,
let's look at the maximum chart. Let's go to the maximum chart and see what that looks like. Right. Oh, my word. Okay. NVIDIA. Yeah. Intel has been a disastrous investment going all the way back. Hang on. Let me pull this across. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I'm showing the full graphic. So that line there is NVIDIA. You would have made a 60,000% return if you'd invested in 1999. And the other two don't even feature on this list. Basically, right down.
Yeah, no, AMD is too recent. And the problem is with Intel is Intel has such a big market already. It's difficult for Intel to grow more than what they have. Because it's like, they can only lose. Unfortunately, Intel is in that position where they can only lose. There's no market for them to go into now, because they are in everything.
Yeah.
There is the joke, Intel inside. Intel inside was in everything, like IBM was.
Yes.
Everything had, and now that's why I thought people was like, that's the problem that the stock market isn't really giving you idea of. Intel is huge. Yes. Like, and that's one of my biggest problems with Intel that I had is Intel, when they started up, were even bigger than what they are now, because Intel was in everything.
Yeah.
This is now my problem. It's AMD is now turning into, we are in everything, because we're now that the Earth is Xilinx, we're in space. We in planes, we in boats, we in military, we in farming, like literally we in farming.
It's Xilinx, a risk.
They're in cars, so AMD is now in cars as well. So literally every form of transport that currently exists, AMD is in it now.
Is now in it, yeah.
So where Intel was like that in the old days, Intel literally, like Intel owned retirement homes in the old days. They had medical plans.
Yeah.
Where it's like, this is Intel medical plans, how to make it more efficient. You can see that engineering going into, and they dropped all of that.
It was like IBM. Yeah. I mean, IBM had the same problem. Yeah. They became this massive.
I thought it was like in the old days of Intel, that was even worse. They were in housing, they were in business, building. They were like a Samsung now.
Yeah.
Like Samsung makes everything as well now. Like, they do boats, they do planes, they do freaking. Intel was like that. And Intel lost that. So I would assume if Intel was more like that, and they kept that more typical engineering forte that they could keep, they would be way better than what they are now. So you could see clear mismanagement on their side, completely kind of underhanded them there. You could argue as well, if you get too big like that, it just becomes too difficult to run. But then you could go like Samsung and become Umbrella Corporation and say, sweet. They're all under the same company, but they have their own managers and so forth. Just make it easy internally to buy stock and buy stuff from us internally. It's cheaper to buy from Samsung for Samsung than buying outside.
Yeah.
So AMD is now becoming that way. I think AMD is trying to avoid trying to be too big like that. They're trying to be just the backbone. Saying, leaving themselves up to companies. Because that's now the area where AMD is now trying to... You're seeing Intel trying to like catch up now with the custom designs. Because AMD has a massive custom design. Everybody likes AMD's custom designs.
That's why
they have so many orders from the military and from aeronautics. And then you've got the console guys buying from them. All of those guys are like, oh, it's nice to work with AMD because they actually work with you.
Yes, yes. So coming back to my question, if you were to buy $1,000 in one of these three companies today and you were going to keep it in stocks in AMD, NVIDIA, or Intel, and you were going to keep it for 3 years, and I'm going to hold you to this, Herod, because we're going to come back and do a podcast in 3 years to see how well you did.
Yeah.
Which one would you pick today?
At the moment now, AMD.
AMD
is just going to grow more and more and more. Now with Xilinx acquisition, their market is just going to market cap on what they can buy and what they can sell. Because they in their server market, they'll just go up now.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the advantage now with AMD, now that guys are switching over to AMD servers, same as Intel. Once you hook them, they're going to stay with you for a couple of years.
Yeah.
It's not like they're not going to change their server in the next 2 years. They're going to change the servers in the next 4 years. So if AMD has a customer now, that's a customer for the at least for the next 3 to 4 years. They have got that person as a customer. So AMD, whatever AMD's profits now are what they're still going to make next year and the year after that, because they're going to still buy AMD CPUs. And then because Intel doesn't have something to compete yet with properly with server yet, AMD is now just going to take off all those servers, and that's just easy money. You make this, make products, you sell them. That's why even AMD... A frustrating problem from AMD is AMD could have made more money is if they just had more chips to manufacture.
Right.
And they literally like, and they bought all the allocation they could. They're starting to compete with Apple with allocation now.
So
that's now where you can start seeing like Apple, AMD, you can see more and more of the acquisition pie from TSMC is AMD's buying a lot more capacity over and over and over. And you're going to start seeing them clashing with Apple. Because Apple has a lot more cash, though, because again, they've got a software company, and software companies will always make more money than hardware companies. That's just how it's going to be. So AMD's going to fight against that. But again, AMD has way more potential growth areas. And I think there's where you will see one of the areas with TSMC is they look at AMD as a growing customer. They see Apple as a stationary customer. Because Apple... How many more chips can Apple sell?
True. It's mostly iPhones that they make for you.
So they've got no area to grow.
Yeah.
They can only sell X amount of Apple chips at a time. They cannot sell more. AMD can, because they can take business from Intel. And Intel is a competitor to TSMC. So TSMC is, for them, it would go, okay, let's help Apple, AMD, because AMD makes us more money.
Good point. Good point.
So I told people, it's like, you would rather go to where you can grow business. Whereas with Apple, you're not growing business. It's just, it's the same business. You can just charge them more money because you can give them extra favors. That's why Apple has a massive advantage, because they're already sitting at like, I think they're already on the pioneering node of from TSMC with 4 nanometer, and they'll be the first ones on 3. I can guarantee you that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But to that, to show you how aggressive it becomes, I could. The feeling I have and what I'm feeling is I'm starting to see TSMC making a specific node for AMD as well to compete against Intel. So Intel can get nodes from them as well, but they're not going to get the nodes that AMD can. So I'll check it this year, but I can clearly see. And again, the fact is, because AMD is one of those pioneering companies, it's better for you to have AMD, because AMD will actively help you to make a better product. Because they have a ambition to make better chips and all those other things. Same as Apple, but the problem is Apple doesn't have that engineering finesse that AMD has with pioneering.
Right.
So AMD would go and help them with 3D stacking. AMD is now launching their, 5800 XT stacking chip now. So AMD is the first company that actually is using TSMC stacking technology. and that was co-developed by AMD. So they didn't just AMD didn't just do this on their own. Mm. Neither did TSMC sit on their asses and not do this. This is like we work together to make something that both of us companies can benefit from. And now TSMC can take that and sell that to other companies, which they can go, okay, AMD, you helped us, we help you.
So AMD on the ascendancy in the coming years, but Intel can never be discounted. They are a very
Intel, powerful Intel company. In the next, I would say now that Pat's in the races, I would say probably in the desktop market, it's going to be very aggressive. So our consumer market, we're going to have it now where 1 year AMD, 1 year Intel. 1 year AMD, 1 year Intel. We're going to see that happening. Bah, 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 bah.
Which so is I think great in the consumer the market.
We're going to start seeing stupid, like on at least, I think the next gen AMD chip, the one that's launching this year, will probably at least be like 30% faster per core.
Wow, wow.
And that's
and pricing will be good too.
Well, probably. That has to be aggressive compared to Intel. You see, that's now the advantage of having Intel's there, and Intel's pricing is very stable because they're so big. So that's Intel's big advantage. Just because they're so big, for them to manufacture something is, once they start manufacturing, it's easy. Problem is, because you're so big, it's difficult to do. It's difficult to make niche products when you're that big. So AMD has that advantage where they can make niche products and they can now start scaling with certain products. So we'll see AMD is now reliant on TSMC just to up the output capacity, and you can see them spending stupid amount of money to get that done and so forth. So AMD has a lot more areas to grow. NVIDIA, my problem with NVIDIA is there's a lot of hype. I would say they're one of the like the Tesla stock. They remind me of crypto boys and so forth, where it's like, yeah, just buy their stock. And then just stock just artificially goes up because everybody goes, but nobody really goes and says, okay, but how much IP do they have? How good is this thing actually? When you look at it, it's like, I tell you, it's like, how can NVIDIA stock be more than Intel? Mm-hmm. Intel has more IP. If Intel goes bankrupt, they're worth stupid amount of money. If NVIDIA goes bankrupt, how much are they worth? How much is their intellectual property worth, really? Mm-hmm. They do GPUs.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do they do?
They do a lot of stuff in data center now.
Well, exactly. It's all based on GPU. Yeah. They went and said, let's put GPU into everything, which is a good marketing thing because you're good at making GPUs. Problem is, you're over-reliant on making GPUs then, because even their networking stuff is based off GPUs.
Yeah.
That's why they wanted to buy ARM. Because they kind of knew, guys, what happens if somebody like completely out-engineers us in GPUs? Then what? Then they're reliant on the software. And, NVIDIA's not the best of the best software companies in the world. They are good.
Yeah.
Please be understand, it's like they have a very freaking lucrative market there with CUDA, with their software there. Sure. But if they lose that, like what happened with the recent hack with NVIDIA, what
and Intel is CUDA's coming for them.
Well, Intel's coming for them, but what happens if the source code for CUDA leaks and somebody can, the Chinese, can re-engineer that and say, sweet, we'll make this thing that you, who's going to go and sue a Chinese company? That's my problem is NVIDIA's, they've got too many eggs in one basket.
They're vulnerable,
That's my problem with NVIDIA. It's like, yes, they are a good company, all those things, but it's like, yeah, it's a pity the ARM thing didn't go through for them. I think there's a lot of companies saying, thank fudge that they didn't, because a lot of those companies would have really like thrown all kinds of toys out of the cot if that happened.
Yeah, it was always unlikely.
NVIDIA kind of felt like they were pushed in the corner to do that, because where else do they have to go?
So what does Jensen Huang do next? Well, let's leave that for the NVIDIA podcast.
We can leave that for later.
We are over an hour, so I'm conscious of time. I think let's wrap this podcast here. It's been fascinating. Before we go into episode 3 of AMD, I think we do need to tackle Intel next time. And that I think is also going to be a two-parter episode. There's a lot to cover on Intel. We've covered a lot of it in the first two episodes on AMD, but there's a lot more to delve into, of course.
They are mutually, they are exclusive, but they are joined by the hip, but their heads are, and their hands are fighting one another. So it's
like some alien beast.
Yes, well, it's one of those things where it's like, if you can look at it like, oh, what if, because again, by the time AMD wanted to buy ATI, AMD could have bought NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm.
How would the future be now if AMD bought NVIDIA now? it would be a very different world you would live in if NVIDIA and AMD actually merged back then, and Jensen took over AMD. That is the future I would actually want to see, and see what would have happened if Jensen was in charge of AMD now, back then. How things would have changed. Like that would have been a very amazing. Wouldn't have happened. It's like he's too arrogant for that to happen, but that's a parable world that I would like to
to go back
look
and
at and see what happened in that universe and that timeline if that actually happened.
Fascinating stuff. As always, Gerard, it's fascinating chatting to you. It's been a pleasure. We've covered AMD now. We could have carried on for a third podcast on AMD, but we're not going to do that. But we're gonna delve into Intel next time and probably stretch that over two episodes as well, just as we said, because there is so much to cover before we get on to who is our third topic. I think it's NVIDIA, actually. Companies are so interlinked. And then we're going to do Apple. Apple. Lots to talk about still.
Yeah, and we can do an episode of the future of all of them all together.
Kind
of did now and say, where are they going? But we can do that later when we get closer to the launches of those chips. Then it's easier to speculate and so forth.
And there's so much more to talk about in the PC industry. I think we're going to end up doing many series of this particular podcast, Everything PC. We won't only focus on silicon. We'll look at other issues as well. We'll look at Windows versus Mac OS, for example.
Yes, Microsoft and Office.
Fascinating discussion on its own. So much to talk about. I'm really looking forward to the rest of only this series, but all of these podcasts. So thank you for joining us. And if you're not subscribed, please do so. We do go out on YouTube. We actually haven't released any of these shows yet, but there will be a YouTube channel. We'll also push it out over Tech Central's YouTube channel as well. But do get subscribed up, because we'll only do that for the first few episodes. Do get subscribed up to the Everything PC YouTube channel. We'll share all of the details on Tech Central regarding how to subscribe to that. And we'll also, of course, be available in your favorite podcasting application, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, iTunes, and all the rest of them. Just search for Everything PC, two words, and you should find us. We'll also include all the details to the podcast on Tech Central's website. So get subscribed. If you've got any feedback, we really should create a shared email address for this podcast. But at the moment, we haven't done that yet. Let's do it for our next episode, Gerard. But if you want to mail us in the interim, Gerard works at a computer retail outfit in Midrand called Computers Only. If you want him to build a computer for you, he'll do it with great pleasure.
Yes.
Or if you just want to chat to him, his email address is Gerard P. That's with an H. Gerard P. At computersonly.co.za, or you can mail myself, or mail both of us, Duncan at techcentral.co.za. We'd love to hear from you. Give us some feedback on the show. What would you like us to cover in future episodes? We look forward to having some guests on the show at some point as well. We've got a few names in mind, and we'll look forward, not necessarily in season one, but we'll definitely have some guests on in future seasons of the podcast. And so it won't be just us two talking all the time. We'll have some expert insights, and maybe we'll even get some experts from these companies themselves onto the show at some point to give their viewpoints. Who knows, Gerard, maybe we'll have Jensen on the podcast at some point to rebut your criticism. You never know.
Well, he'll be bullish enough to answer some of them at least then.
I'm sure he will. I mean, he's combative, and I think he'd
I think he'd
welcome the opportunity. So hopefully at some point we might pull that off.
A miracle one. We'll pull off a Jensen.
We'll pull off a Jensen. And maybe we'll get Lisa on at the same time.
You never know.
You never know. Excellent. Well, until next time, until episode 3, when we unpack Everything Intel, and I'm really looking forward to that discussion from Gerard and myself. Have a great time, and happy computing.